Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. They have worked hard to gain our attention, our trust, and let's not mince words here, our money. But do they deserve those things? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's hard to even picture what the world would look like in this moment if these four horsemen of tech companies had never existed, shaping not just markets, but lifestyles. So many of us interact with these companies on a daily basis that we sometimes forget to ask challenging questions about them. Why do they employ relatively small numbers of people as compared with their value? Are they actually as benevolent as their leaders insist? And would it be worse to see one of them collapse or get even bigger? Scott Galloway is an entrepreneur and a professor at the Stern School of Business at New York University. His new book is called The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
It really is strange how little I had thought about it, but it's definitely true for me. I interact with those four companies, or at least the stuff they make, every day. What do the four horsemen have in common?
I think each of them taps into a very basic instinct. Google kind of foots to our need for a super being. Our advantage as a species is an especially big brain that's robust enough to ask difficult questions, but not intelligent enough to answer all of them. So we've always had a need for super beings. And as economic growth sets in and education goes up in a society, church attendance and reliance on a super being declines. But at the same time, we still have these very difficult questions. So now we have something that fills that void, and that is Google. And if you were to really, really analyze everything you've asked of Google to answer for you, you would recognize that you trust Google more than any priest, rabbi, scholar, mentor, or boss. We entrust Google with our most sacred thoughts, and Google knows more about us than any being or any individual in our lives. Facebook taps into our need to love. We are using images to catalyze and reinforce relationships and bonds. Amazon's our consumptive gut, the penalty for too little starvation, the penalty for too much is lethargy or gluttony. But we always have this feeling, open your cupboards 10x to 100x more than you need, but we still want more. And then finally, Apple, I think, taps into our instinct to procreate. I think Apple is the new signal that you have good genes, that you're part of the innovation class, you're wealthy, you get it, and that you would make a good mate.
All right, I want to talk about Amazon first. It's true, I can buy just about anything on their website, and this is our urge to hunt and gather. But honestly, like Walmart and Target have websites that offer a whole lot of things they don't carry in their stores. What did Amazon do to position itself to really dominate?
So Amazon changed the compact or the agreement between the markets and shareholders and Amazon, and that is Amazon has replaced profits with vision and growth. And as a result, the company's operated at break even for longer than any company of its size or market capitalization has been able to do. And the result is that when you shop at Target or Walmart and you give them a dollar, they give you somewhere between 80 and 92 cents worth of products and services back, whereas when you shop at Amazon and you give them a dollar, they give you 100 cents on the dollar back in terms of products and services. So as a result, I mean, to be blunt, Amazon is just a better value for the consumer, and they're able to offer more convenience, more value, and more selection. And other retailers can't compete because their shareholders demand that they give them 10, 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar back to them, not back to the consumer.
I'm old enough to remember when Amazon was cool because it could offer just about any book you wanted, but nothing else. What was the benefit of the approach of starting with books? Was it just about learning how to do distribution well now that it sells everything from rat poison to rechargeable batteries?
I'm not sure that the books as a starting point was that meaningful, or if it was meaningful, I haven't figured it out. I think what you have here is the master storyteller who in his letter to shareholders, Jeff Bezos, outlines sort of these non-perishable consumer truisms of value, convenience, and selection. And these things just haven't gone away. And the market's infatuation with the company that keeps bidding the stock up has given it the cheap capital. Amazon can access the debt markets for a lower cost of capital than China. So Amazon is considered a better debt from lenders right now than China. And as a result, they're able to build out fulfillment infrastructure, offer selection that just no one can manage. So I don't know if it was if they had started anywhere else, it would have resulted in any less a dominant company.
I recently shifted my shopping so that Amazon automatically delivers garbage bags and toilet paper and iron pills to my house at the intervals that I need them. They tapped into the realization that not every kind of shopping is fun to go do at the store.
That's absolutely right. And I think pretty soon you're going to expand those three or four SKUs to 70 or 80% of your entire retail world. I think that's where we're heading with a fulfillment network that has a warehouse within 20 miles of 45% of the U.S. population, your purchase history, Amazon Alexa, which you'll be able to manicure purchases with, and then layer on top of it artificial intelligence and now grocery. Pretty soon you might be part of a pilot that opts into Amazon and says, look, send me stuff before I know I want it. And whatever I don't want, I'll send back because you can pick it up efficiently and easily. And if I want to manicure something and say, all right, I want calcium pills in addition to iron pills, you just say Alexa and order it. So I think we're headed towards this, what I would refer to as this Amazon singularity, where if you want to go buy a pair of Christian Louboutins or a Panerai watch or a Porsche, that stuff's fun. Go at it. Go buy it. But the 70, 80, 90% of low consideration, tedious purchases in our lives, I think we're going to outsource all of them to one retailer, and that retailer is going to be Amazon.
Do they make or lose money on all those Prime memberships they sell?
Amazon purposely breaks even. So they're quite profitable. The cloud business, for example, is very profitable. But I don't know if you saw the announcement earlier this week. They're actually subsidizing the cost of products on their marketplace because Amazon doesn't want to be profitable, because once you give an investor profits, it's like giving a crack addict cocaine. It's just you don't want to get the addict hooked on the heroin of profits, because if you ever then take it away, the addict gets very irritable. So Amazon purposely runs a break even, reinvesting 100 cents in the dollar back in the consumer experience. So I don't think they, as long as consumers or as long as investors continue to bid up their stock, the worst thing they could do is go profitable, because they're effectively going underwater with the largest tank of oxygen, forcing every retailer to follow them with smaller tanks, and other retailers are going to start drowning.
So that's all well and good for me as a consumer, but as an investor, it seems that that would be frustrating. I suppose investors just know that the value of the stock itself will go up even if they don't reap any dividends?
Well, that's the key point, is we've never seen anything like this. We've typically, companies are given sort of a 2 or 3 year grace period in the private markets to get profitable. And then usually when they go public, they're already profitable and they're expected to increase those profits every year. But Amazon has replaced profits with vision and growth. And people are so intoxicated by the service, the growth. Amazon grew 34% quarter on quarter last quarter, which means that this $100 billion plus retailer is doubling every 27 months. And they're so dominant and so good at what they do that investors love the stock. The stock keeps going up, so it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's become a default currency, internet staple, whatever the right term is. So investors absolutely love Amazon. It's been one of the best performing stocks in history. And now I think the fourth or fifth most valuable company in the world. But it raises some very interesting questions we haven't had to ask before. And that is, if a company can get to $500 billion in value and pay almost no corporate income tax. Amazon has paid $1.4 billion in corporate income tax since the Great Recession, while Walmart has paid $64 billion. And this is in the face of Amazon adding the entire market capitalization of Walmart in the last 2 years. So Amazon much more successful than Walmart from a market capitalization standpoint, yet Walmart paying 40x the amount of corporate income tax. We haven't faced this type of dynamic before.
There's also the reality, and Walmart comes in for a lot of criticism about how it treats and pays its employees, but it does put lots of people to work. Relatively speaking, Amazon's workforce is pretty small.
Yeah, Amazon has substantially ramped hiring. It's now, I think, above 500,000 people, and it's a lot of those people are across its back end. But if you look at all four, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, you have about 750,000 employees, which is sort of the population of the Lower East Side of Manhattan, who have combined market capitalization equal to the GDP of India. So take the entire economic output of a $1.1 billion nation, a billion-person nation, and then spread it across the Lower East Side, and it gives you a sense for the outsized value creation. You have Ford Motor, hundreds of, 100 or 150,000 employees, $50 billion market cap. So 150,000 middle-class households being supported by a $50 billion company called Ford. And then you have Facebook, about $470 billion in market capitalization with 24,000 people. It gets even worse in the private markets. Uber now has the market valuation of Airbus at $70 billion. And just this last year, they increased their employee base from 8,000 people to 12,000 because they've managed to create sort of this two-class system. And they have 2.1 million driver partners, which is Latin for people who don't get benefits or share in the equity upside. So they've managed to figure out a way to decrease the number of people who participate in the market capitalization or the shareholder growth of a company down to 12,000 people.
Apple appeals to our instinct to procreate. Apple products are literally sexier than similarly functional counterparts offered by other brands?
Yeah, I think so. I think that luxury brands do one of two things. They make us feel closer to God because we're used to seeing objects of beauty and artisanship in places of worship, whether it's frescoes or beautiful statues or gorgeous music or great apparel surrounded by wonderful music in places of worship. So you begin to associate beauty with godliness. So you see the slope on the back of a 911 or the mesh on a Bottega Veneta bag, and it stills you and makes you feel more in the moment, if you will, and more spiritual. It also signals that you have good genes. It says you're powerful. It says you're wealthy. It says you're elegant. It says you have high cheekbones or longer legs. It's very instinctive and very primal. And people will pay a lot of money and a lot of margin to feel more attractive to the other sex, whether it's paying $200 for a pair of Diesel jeans, $55 or $38 for a Chanel lipstick, or $1,200 for an iPhone X, which is basically saying, I get it. I have good genes. I'm part of the innovation class. I live in a city. I'm a better mate, is what you're saying when you have the iOS. The iOS is effectively a heat map for wealth. You go into the wealthiest regions in the world, it's all iOS. You go into the red states and rural areas where household income plummets, and it's all Android.
We can buy Apple products lots of places. We can buy it online. We can buy it at the mobile phone carrier. We can go to a big box electronics store. Why did Apple make the investment in all those gleaming blonde wood showrooms that they have?
Crazy, irrational, at the time stupid decision that is probably the most value-creating decision in the history of business. And that is 2002, Steve Jobs goes to his board just as e-commerce is taking off and stores are beginning to show weakness as a distribution channel and says, I know, we're going to invest in this dying medium called stores, and spends the next decade and a half building 450 temples to the brand, reallocating $4 to $6 billion out of advertising into leases, because he, you know, very deftly saw that the part of brand building that's pre-purchase, which is mostly advertising, was declining in effectiveness. Fewer and fewer people are watching advertising. Advertising has become the tax that the poor and the technologically illiterate pay. I would bet in your own personal life you're finding you're watching media that has one thing in common, and that is it's not ad-supported, whether it's HBO or Netflix. So that he recognized that the brand still does get built at the point of purchase, whether it's going into a Best Buy, going into an AT&T or Verizon store. If they could make it better and make it a really fantastic first experience or contact, it's almost like the handshake or the first kiss when you consummate a relationship. If they could make that a fantastic experience, it would have still a lot of resonance in terms of the brand and the relationship. And they built these unbelievable temples to the brand, not unlike what Vuitton has done or some of the high-end brands. And the result is a company with the operating margins of an Hermes or a Ferrari.
My guest is Scott Galloway, professor at the Stern School of Business at New York University and a serial entrepreneur himself. His new book is called The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or go to Twitter. We are at KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scott Galloway, who's a professor at the Stern School of Business at NYU. His new book is called The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Scott, what has Apple done to shore up its defenses against the possibility that somebody else might come out with a mobile phone that is objectively better than an iPhone?
Well, as we were discussing, I think their stores, they've created analog moats. These companies are great at using digital technology and network effects to scale faster than any company in their sector previously. But once they have access to cheap capital, they usually try and put in place some sort of analog moat. So Amazon is putting in place a back-end fulfillment infrastructure of warehouses and 757s and tractor trailers, and there's even threatening to go into overnight delivery that will take someone else billions of dollars, and decades to replicate. Apple's done the same thing with 450 stores. Samsung may come out with a better phone next year, but they're just not going to be able to replicate that distribution network for at least a decade. Facebook's talking about laying cable across the ocean. Google's been, laying fiber in certain cities. Everybody's looking for moats, and it can be around intellectual property. But some of the most effective moats are these more analog ones that are just very difficult to replicate. But in the case of Apple, I would say the moat is their stores.
We debate over how genuine the emotions conveyed over Facebook are, but we do seem to crave that sense of connection, that possibility for approval, even if we're not entirely convinced it's real.
Sure. And your ability to maintain relationships is sort of second order or second degree relationships is really compelling and really, I think it speaks directly to our need to care for others and be cared for. But also just the dopamine hit you get from immediate feedback. How many people liked my comment, or did people thumbs up, thumbs down? It's really the slot machine effect, the rush you get just before those numbers or those symbols come up. And with social media, whether it's going on YouTube and seeing how many people watched your video or seeing how many people liked your image on Instagram, that dopamine hit is literally addictive. And we all want those hits during the day, and we want to go on our phones and on our social media platforms and see and get immediate feedback.
If I buy a car or a sweater or a microwave, the more I use it, the less value it retains because stuff just wears out eventually. How is that different when we're dealing with a product like Facebook?
So if you look at the 13 companies that have outperformed the S&P 500 5 years in a row, 9 of the 13 have one thing in common, and they're what I would refer to as Benjamin Button companies, and that is they age in reverse. The economic titans of yesteryear had companies that aged similar to the way we did, and that is over time, a car that rolled off the assembly line at General Motors plant or screwing the top off of a tube of Colgate, the decline in value was 20 to 90%, and it continued to decline in value. They age similar to the way we age. 9 of the 13 companies that have outperformed the S&P 500 age in reverse. They've suspended the natural order. When you turn on Waze, the GPS ping to your phone updates the algorithm and traffic patterns for other people. When you conduct a search on Google, it's 1/3 billionth of better because if you type in public radio in Dallas, the information that person then clicks on informs other people doing similar searches. So this reverse aging seems to be the key component or the key attribute across companies that are adding not tens of millions or even hundreds of millions in value, but tens of billions of dollars in value.
What are these companies doing with all the personal information they collect from us? I mean, we can see, you can see ads following you around if you've searched for something. But what are they doing with all those, as you mentioned, the things that we confess to Google with our searches? What happens to that information?
So, that's a correct question, and there's a lot of different answers. Loosely, I would say that they're trying to use it to improve the product. I don't think these are bad people. I don't think there's anything sinister here. I think Google is very cognizant of just how much power they have. If there was a hack and we could put everyone's name and face above every Google search query, we would pretty easily, just putting some kind of very limited artificial intelligence on top of that, find out you know, what diseases you have, what diseases you're scared of getting. Are you planning to get divorced? Are you planning to get married? There's just, what stocks are you planning to buy? Are you planning to sue your business partner? You trust Google not only with what you're thinking, but sort of what you're about to think, because the questions and your intentions begin to format your intentions and in your subsequent actions. So it's pretty frightening the amount of data they have, but they are quick to point out that they attempt to anonymize data and not string it to specific identities. Facebook's probably been a little bit more aggressive or a little less, I would say, a little more tone deaf in terms of some of the uses of their data for targeting around advertising. But consumers are, you know, understandably pretty concerned. The concern is, I don't think these are bad people planning to do anything sinister with them. Most consumers do, in fact, agree to a certain level of privacy violation in exchange for utility. You're comfortable with Uber knowing exactly where you are and exactly where you're going at what time, such that the car can more easily find you. And most people willingly trade off that privacy. What is more concerning lately is that these platforms have shown they're not capable of ensuring they don't get weaponized by bad actors. And what happens when feasibly an intelligence unit of the Russian government gets access to what are 2.1 billion listening devices called your phone, where the mic is on when you're in app, in the Facebook app, the mic is on and the ambient listening is on to try and serve you more relevant ads, which is, you know, argue if that's good or bad. Most people decide to put up with it. But do we really want bad actors having access to all this data? So there's some very serious issues here. And then finally, Apple has decided to go the other way and is refusing access to the iPhone, even if it's from an FBI requested court order, because they feel that the opportunity is to go entirely the other way and say, kind of, we don't want your data, that and any data you put on our device is safe from anybody else.
All right, let's go to the phone now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have another Scott calling us from Irving. Hi, Scott.
Hi, my question for the guest is that we all know that Google, and this also applies to Facebook, is worth trillions or billions of dollars. So my question is, I use Google, I would say, quite a bit. I pay them absolutely nothing. Where do they get all that money from?
Sure, Scott. So if you type in a Dallas Cowboys schedule because you want to know when the Cowboys are playing, that's the fact that you're potentially have raised your hand and identified yourself as someone who's interested in Cowboys games. The Dallas Cowboys may want to run an ad along the right rail saying, you know, thinking about season tickets to the Cowboys, or would you like Cowboys merchandise? So every time you do a search, to a certain extent, you're identifying a little bit about yourself, whether if you're doing a search for weather in Orlando, Disney World, or weather at Disney World, or best times to go to Disney World, Disney can immediately know that you're thinking about coming to Disney World, and hotels in the region can be in running ads along the right rail. So they'll bid on key terms. So Tiffany will bid on Mother's Day jewelry gift. And it's a very powerful model. And as a result, they have created a company worth $700 billion that'll do, I think, $70 or $80 billion in revenue this year, with profits of, you know, $20 or $30 billion. So it's a very powerful model.
All right. Next to Tom in Austin. Hi, Tom.
Hi. This topic is very interesting, and I plan to get the book. My question is, if you could project out in, let's say, 100 years, could you name off, could you name off in order what companies you think would fail first to last?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the question, and I appreciate your support. So 100 years, I have just absolutely no idea. Of the companies in the Dow 100, the 100 largest companies from a century ago, only 11 are still around. So if you have a kid right now and you live in an advanced economy in a wealthy household or upper middle class or above, your kid's life expectancy is 100. So all of our kids are going to outlive these companies. I would say the most vulnerable right now is probably Facebook, because of the fact that it's pretty much a one-trick pony around advertising, and also I think some of the concerns around their weaponization by the GRU, the intelligence unit of the Russian government, has made them more vulnerable, and I think they've handled the crisis poorly. Whereas if you look at Apple, Apple's in several businesses. Amazon is in, you know, three different trillion-dollar businesses, retail, advertising, and the cloud. And Apple just has this extraordinary brand. I bet long-term Google's be around a while, because I think they've assembled more just raw IQ horsepower than any firm in the world. So I think the most vulnerable is Facebook. But I think they're all going to be around for probably 10 to 20 years at least. But I would bet that none of them are around in their current form in 50 years. And the only brand that's probably around in 100 years is Apple, just because it has so much heritage and artisanship there. But 100 years, wow, who knows?
Do they have to guard against sort of becoming calcified or complacent as they get bigger and bigger and bigger?
Oh, sure. You know, we all do. And by the way, when pundits like me or academics start saying that a company is too powerful or that they have too much momentum, that's usually when they start to go into structural decline. So it'll be interesting to see. And there's a couple kids in a dorm room at MIT or Caltech or Berkeley right now that are coming up with something the other guys don't see and have nothing to lose and aren't afraid and aren't trying to protect legacy assets and are too stupid to know they're going to fail, who will come in and probably give these companies a run for their money. But right now, I don't see it. Facebook has an app that goes out and monitors every other app. And when an app is getting traction, they can identify the components or the features of that app that are working and then incorporate them into their own app such that, you know, these kids, these babies never see their teen years. They're basically put out of business. And if they do get a ton of momentum and it's something Facebook can't copy, they go out and acquire them. So Facebook now owns 6 of the top 10 apps and 3 of the 5 companies that got to 100 million users the fastest. So when you're on your phone 80% of the time, you're in app. So, and 6 of the top 10 apps are Facebook. So you're not carrying around a cell phone. You're carrying around a delivery mechanism for Facebook.
My guest is Scott Galloway. We're talking about his new book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Scott, it's notable that all the companies in the Big Four are American. Is there something about the U.S. business climate that has allowed them to grow up and grow rich here, or is it a coincidence?
Oh, no. It's clear. There's clearly something in the water here. The easy answer is yes, there's clearly something about our culture, our system that works or that seems to give rise to these unbelievable innovators. The question is, what is it? And it's a combination, I think, of our education system. Culturally, I don't want to say we embrace failure. I've never bought that, but we tolerate it. Whereas I think a lot of societies, it's a scarlet letter if you start a business and it fails. We have a very robust venture capital community. There are a lot of venture capitalists who have made billions of dollars taking crazy bets and putting millions of dollars into small companies. So we just have more access to funding. If you're a young woman getting out of Dartmouth with an engineering degree and you can put together a business plan, you're going to have an easier time raising $3, $5, or $10 million in New York or San Francisco than any city in the world. And there's more lawyers here. There's, they don't understand venture finance. There's more software engineers. So tax system, culture of not tolerating failure, sophisticated venture community, great engineering universities, and this American optimism that leads us to take crazy risks that occasionally turn out to be crazy genius.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Bill calling from Wimberley. Hey, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
Love your show. My question is in relation to the service industry and all these wonderful high-tech products that we can buy now. You know, say you've spent $800 on a smart TV, and it lasts for 4 or 5 years, and then it's kaput. Is it just because Amazon's giving you 100% for what you buy? Are you just in the situation of throw it away, get a new one?
Hi, Bill. Yeah, for the most part. I don't know if you're old enough to remember going to downtown or where all the stores were, and there were something called the repair shop. There was a shoe repair shop. There was TV repair. Now the cost of a flat-screen television, you can get a decent flat-screen television for $200-$300. So if it breaks, one of two things is going to happen. A nice man in a brown outfit is going to come take it, send it back to the manufacturer, fix it for free, and bring it back to you for fear that, you know, in hopes that you don't go on Twitter and badmouth it. Or they're going to say you're out of warranty and you're just going to go buy a new one, or maybe even have it delivered the next day from Best Buy or Amazon. So the the deflation of prices across consumer products has, to a certain extent, made them disposable. And also just different financing methods. We now lease cars and turn them in every 2 or 3 years. But there's no reason to go get your vacuum cleaner repaired. The manufacturer will either fix it for free and come get it from you, or you'll just go buy a new one because relative to 10, 15 years ago, or even 20 years ago, they're just not that expensive. More expensive to repair it than to get a new one.
So, Scott, you list Uber as among the companies that are poised for potential accession to this very highest echelon. I'm curious about Uber. If autonomous cars are perfected and, generally speaking, affordable, would they help or hurt Uber's model?
So Uber, right now, drivers, it would help Uber because right now drivers are just, you know, pretty much just a cost. Uber is becoming, the opportunity for Uber to become one of the fifth horsemen is to become an operating system for all transportation, where you just press a logo and say, I want to be in West Palm Beach tomorrow, and it'll tell you not only the Uber to get you to the airport, but which airport you should go to and which flight you should take, and then have the Uber waiting for you when you get there. So driverless is a big boon for someone like Uber. The question is, should Uber be the one to develop that technology, or should they, you know, they didn't develop automobile technology. They're just free riding off of it, if you will. They didn't invest any money in combustion engines, but the Ford that shows up has been paid for by somebody else. They invested in the software to figure out a seamless way to get the car to you and then get you to your location and then have you just bomb out of the back seat without paying for it, and also the trust that the person you're getting in a car with has been vetted.
My guest is Scott Galloway. He's professor at the Stern School of Business at New York University and author of a new book called The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scott Galloway. He's a serial entrepreneur and professor at the Stern School of Business at New York University. His book is called The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Scott, are any of the Big Four or their closest competitors susceptible, given their current trajectories, to antitrust laws?
So I'm not an antitrust lawyer, but my general understanding of antitrust in the U.S. is that if it's good for the consumer, it's difficult to take antitrust action against the company. And it would be difficult to make an argument that these companies are bad for the consumer. They offer such incredible utility. I was speaking to someone the other day who said they'd spend a lot more for their phone, and most of these products are offered to the consumer for free because you end up being the product, or at least the data you provide them. The one that's probably the most vulnerable from traditional antitrust concerns is Google, because it has a 90%+ share. So it has an incredible concentration of market share in an industry or a sector that by dollar volume is now bigger than the entire advertising market of every country with the exception of the U.S. The company that feels the most dominant right now and is creating the most disruption, if you will, is Amazon. In every area they go into, they create tremendous havoc and start sucking the oxygen out of the room and taking all the market capitalization from their competitors. Whenever they even threaten to go into a sector, whether it's drugstores or furniture, you see every other stock in that category decline substantially upon the announcement that Amazon is just thinking about it. But by traditional antitrust standards, I think it's probably Google's most vulnerable. I do think there'll be regulation, but it's not going to come out of Washington. It's going to come out of Brussels. I think in Europe, they register all of the downside of these companies with a fraction of the upside, which is going to stiffen their backbone. So you're going to see regulation. I just think it's going to come out of Europe.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Taylor is calling from Florida. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. I just had a question for Scott regarding, some news about Intel and AMD, like how they're cooperating to create a new processor for their laptop line. And this is basically an action to compete against NVIDIA. How do you feel about that? Or what would be the best, thing for Intel or AMD to do, with NVIDIA being their biggest competitor at the moment?
Well, what you're seeing is the dominance of some key players who emerge. NVIDIA's done a great job and has also kind of become the go-to chip, I think, for smart driving cars. So its stock has just skyrocketed. And what you have is a lot of strange bedfellows. So Google partnering with Walmart. You're seeing a lot of, just as when the Panzer tanks from Germany rolled into Slovakia and Poland, all of a sudden the British, the Russians, and the Americans found a way to get along. You're going to see a lot of alliances you never would have imagined, all trying to compete against a small number of players who are increasingly dominant. And in this case, AMD pairing up with Intel to try and take on NVIDIA, that's just one example. You're going to see this across the ecosystem everywhere where people are pairing up to try and have some chance to counterpunch at the dominant force in that industry.
We have a tweet that asks, will streaming services like Netflix and Hulu turn into the same kind of bureaucracies they want to replace?
Bureaucracies. The streaming, so asynchronous television viewing typically has one thing in common, and that it's not advertising supported. So linear TV is usually ad supported when you're watching broadcast television. And I would say the biggest trend in media is that the media that's growing tends to be non-ad supported, whether it's Spotify or HBO or Netflix, whereas ad-supported media, whether it's print, newspapers, broadcast television, that's struggling because technology is now letting people opt out of advertising if they pay for it. So there's people like me who can download Modern Family from ABC.com just as easily as they can from Apple TV, which charges me $2.99 but offers me 21 minutes of uninterrupted storytelling versus ABC.com, which litters that great content with 9 minutes of advertising. And so for $2.99, I'll endure, it's worth it to me to not have the advertising. And I think consumers are opting that way. Advertising is slowly but surely becoming a tax that the poor and the technologically illiterate have to pay.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Brian is calling from Tomball. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You touched a second ago on, just replacing items rather than having them repaired because the prices are coming down so much. And, especially on computers, they've just dropped drastically, whereas they used to be thousands and thousands of dollars before. Why is it that in the cell phone industry, cell phone prices continue to go up instead of down?
So thanks for the question, Brian. So I think that they go up, maybe with the exception of Apple and maybe Samsung. But if you're willing to sign a phone contract, you can get a phone for free. It just may not be the phone you want. My sense is across the sector, I mean, when we think about phones, we tend to think of the iPhone. And the iPhone and Apple phones only have about, 13 or 15% share, but they command 90% of the profits because of that premium pricing that comes from sort of signaling affluence and part of the innovation class. But if you walk into a Verizon or an AT&T and you're willing to sign up for a plan, they'll give you a phone. So I don't know. I'm not sure I agree. If you looked across the average price of all phones sold in America, I think you would still see deflation or prices coming down. It's just that the world is bifurcating into sort of value or value plus. It's either Walmart or Tiffany. And we want either the lowest price available on a good product. And it used to be low-priced products were cheap and not well-made. That's not true any longer. Toyota's an amazing car. You can get great products at Walmart. They just don't have artisanship or self-expressive benefit. Or we want something that's in an aquamarine blue box that says you're willing to pay a lot of margin to express an emotion or find the best or signal to other people that you have wealth and power. The people in the middle, the JCPenney's, the Sears of the world, which are a little bit of prestige, but a little bit of value, but not really firmly in either camp, you're seeing those brands and those retailers go away.
What seems so brilliant about Apple is that although certainly there are lots of people who literally can't afford Apple products, there are plenty of people who, for example, I work in public radio. I'm not going to walk into a Tesla dealership and have anyone take me seriously. But if I walk into an Apple store, I can stretch and buy that fancy phone probably in a way that a lot of people who are just middle class people can look at Apple products. It's not the same as a Louis Vuitton bag or something.
It's not, but it is your Vuitton bag, or it is, I won't speak to you personally, it really is your way of signaling, you know, men wear ridiculously expensive watches, women wear impossible, you know, ergonomically impossible shoes, and slowly but surely a lot of that is being replaced by this new signaling device of wealth and education and attractiveness called an iPhone. It just sort of communicates that you get it, and for $1,200, the fact that you carry it everywhere, It's a decent value. And what Apple has pulled off is what we thought of was literally impossible in the world of business. And that is companies are usually one of two things. They're either the low-cost leader, a Walmart, you know, a Costco, where they make their money in volume off very low margins, or the premium price products, so an Hermes, a Ferrari, where they have much smaller production volumes but incredible margins because they have great brands or self-expressive benefit or limited edition or only a few people own them, which immediately identifies you as being special and successful. Apple is the only company I can think of in history that is both the low-cost leader, their specific model, the iPhones will be the best-selling specific model, so they're able to use that power in the supply chain to garner components at the lowest price. They can put together that quality of phone for a lower price than anybody else. But at the same time, they're the premium price product. Hmm. So it's the auto equivalent of a auto brand with the margins or prices of Ferrari with the production volumes of Toyota. And as a result, most profitable company in history, Apple will do double the profits this quarter that Amazon has done in its entire history. More cash on hand than the GDP of a Northern European nation. We've never seen a company with this level of profits.
We have a tweet here from Rajendra who asks, what are the new and emerging networks we'll benefit from, and what networks do you want to see coming into the world?
That's a complicated question. So in terms of networks, I understand Rajendra's question is which companies or types of taking advantage of network technology. The company that could potentially be another horseman is Netflix, because it uses this reverse aging. It uses artificial intelligence and your past viewership to make an estimate or a guess of what you want next. Even if it's as simple as you're watching season 5, episode 7 of House of Cards, when it ends, it has the confidence to go, I bet you would love season 5, episode 8, and it begins automatically playing it, even without your permission. And that sounds, for me, that's the most basic but elegant use of artificial intelligence in all of media. And Netflix now kind of controls the second most important screen in our lives, the first being the phone and the second being the television. Millennials spend more time watching Netflix than the rest of cable TV combined. And if they own that screen, there's probably a lot of different businesses they could get into. So I think the networks that potentially have the most upside are probably Netflix. Most people would say Uber. I don't even think Uber's number two. I think the one that probably has the most potential in the private markets is Airbnb, because that network of global travelers that know about Airbnb and then the local supply is key. Whereas all you need with Uber is tens of millions of dollars to start a local ride-hailing app, because you have local supply of drivers and create local demand. But with Airbnb, you have to have global awareness, because people are coming from all over the world when they come into New York. So I think Airbnb has created very, very substantial and deep moats. So long-winded way of saying Netflix, Airbnb, and Uber, I think, are the networks that are going to come up in value over the next 5 to 10 years.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. People have spilled a lot of ink or spent a lot of whatever you call it, online, digital space, talking about how brick-and-mortar stores are going away. You don't actually think that's going to happen anytime soon, if ever.
No. The rumor of the death of stores has been greatly exaggerated. We're going through a rationalization in terms of the sheer number of square footage. We have about three times the square footage per capita of the UK and 50% more than Canada. So we're going through a natural cycle of just getting rid of some of the square footage. Malls grew at double the pace of the population from 1970 to 2015. So the bottom line is there's just too many stores. But as a concept, as a fulfillment network, as a clean, well-lit warehouse that you can pick products up from, as a place to go get expertise and advice, as a place to create a strong brand experience and make people love the brand and the experience, stores are actually more important. And the reason why Amazon spent $14 billion to buy 550 stores is that they're not only stores, they're warehouses, and they're incredibly efficient distribution mechanisms that have been constructed and manned or staffed, I should say, in high-income areas. So the stores are going to continue to play an incredibly robust part of our economy. It's just there's going to be fewer of them, but brands and retailers are going to spend more money across that smaller footprint. They're going to invest more in personnel. People no longer go to stores for products. They go for people. They want to get in and out fast with the help of an individual. And they not only want artificial intelligence, they want organic intelligence. They want to walk into a Best Buy and find out if the Nintendo 3DS is the right handheld for their nephew, because to make a mistake around a gift for your nephew is, you know, an unimaginable crime. So people want the confidence to know, if I have circles around my eyes, I can go into Kiehl's and establish a relationship with a high EQ person who's going to give me the confidence that they know the right way to get rid of the circles under my eyes. So stores aren't going anywhere. There's going to be fewer of them, but I believe we're actually going to spend, or brands are going to spend, more money per square foot.
What do you want your students at the business school at NYU to understand in order to prepare for careers in a future that's hard to predict?
So the first year of business school is an exceptional year. We take these pillars of finance, marketing, operations, and accounting, and we take human capital and we make it 50% more valuable. And that is that kids come out of school can make 40 to 50% more when they came into school. So it's an incredible ROI. I would argue the second year is mostly a waste and an excuse such that graduate institutions can charge kids 2x tuition versus 1x. And I think if we were to try and maintain that velocity of return on investment in the second year, we would basically focus our curriculum around these four companies. Because to really understand search, to really understand media, the intersection between technology innovation and information services, retail, media, is to understand our economy. And I think those skills are in unbelievable demand. So what I tell my students is really understand these companies, the cultures, the technologies, the value proposition, the instinct they tap into, how they've managed to create such unbelievable stakeholder value. There's a lot to be learned from these companies. And the broader message is that we need to know that these companies aren't concerned with the condition of our soul. They're not going to take care of us when we get older. They're for-profit companies, and they should be held to the same scrutiny as the rest of business.
Scott Galloway's new book is called The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Scott, thanks so much for making time for us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. The podcast is at think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.